Chapter 37. On the first Sabbath of November 1846, I asked to be received as a novice of the religious order of the Oblates of Mary Immaculate of Longueuil, whose object is to preach retreats, revivals among the people. No child of the Church of Rome ever entertained more exalted views of the beauty and holiness of the monastic life than I had the day I enrolled myself under its mysterious banners. How easy to secure salvation now! I had only to look to Father Gigures and obey him as my Father in heaven. Yes, his will was to be for me, the will of my God. Though I might err in obeying him, my errors would not be laid to my charge. To save my soul, I will have only to be like a corpse in the hands of my Father Superior, without any anxiety or any responsibility whatever of my own. I was to be led to heaven as the newborn child in the arms of his loving mother. But how short were to be those fine dreams of my poor deluded mind! When on my knees Father Gigius handed me, with great solemnity, the Latin books of the rules of that monastic order, which is the real gospel, warning me that it was a secret book, and he made me solemnly promise that I would never show it to anyone outside of the order. Alone in my cell the next morning, I said to myself, "Have you not 1,000 times heard and said that the Holy Church of Rome absolutely condemns and anathematizes secret societies? After having in vain tried in my mind to reconcile these two things, I happily remembered that I was a corpse, that I had forever given up my private judgment, that my only business now was to obey. As I read with the utmost attention, I soon understood why this book was kept from the eyes of the curates and the secular priests. To my unspeakable amazement, I found that from the beginning to the end, it speaks with the most profound contempt of them all. The oblate who studies his book of rules his only gospel, must leave his mind filled with the idea of his superior holiness, not only over the poor sinful secular priest, but over everyone else. The oblate alone is Christian, holy, and sacred. The rest of the world is lost. The oblate alone is the salt of the earth, the light of the world. I said to myself, is it to attain to this pharisaical perfection that I have left my beautiful and dear parish? However, after some time spent in these despondent reflections, I remembered the frightful, unsuspected and numberless scandals I had known in almost every parish I had visited. I remembered the drunkenness of that curate, the impurities of this one, the ignorance of another, the worldliness and absolute want of faith of others, and concluded that, after all, the oblates were not far from the truth. Finally, I said to myself, after all, if the oblates live a life of holiness, as I expect to find here, is it a crime that they should feel and express among themselves the difference which exists between a regular and a secular clergy? Am I come here to judge and condemn these holy men? No, I came here to save myself by the practice of the most heroic Christian virtues, the first of which is that I should absolutely and forever give up my private judgment, consider myself as a corpse in the hand of my superior. With all the fervor of my soul, I prayed to God and to the Virgin Mary day and night that first week, that I might attain that supreme state of perfection, where I would have no will, no judgment of my own. The days of that first week passed very quickly, spent in prayer, reading and meditation of the scriptures, study of ecclesiastical history and ascetical books, from 5:30 in the morning till 9:30 at night. The meals were taken at the regular hours of 7, 12, and 6 o'clock, during which, with rare exceptions, silence was kept and pious books were read. The quality of the food was good, but at first, before they got a female cook to preside over the kitchen, everything was so unclean that I had to shut my eyes at meals. I would have complained had not my lips been sealed by that strange monastic view of perfection that every religious man is a corpse. What does a corpse care about the cleanness or uncleanness of what is put into its mouth? The third day, having drank at breakfast a glass of milk, which was literally mixed with the dung of the cow, my stomach rebelled, a circumstance which I regretted exceedingly, attributing it to my want of monastic perfection. I envied the high state of holiness of the other fathers who had so perfectly attained to the sublime perfection of submission that they could drink that impure milk just as if it had been clean. One day after tea, we were going through the dining room to the chapel to pass 5 or 10 minutes in adoration of the wafer God. We had two doors to cross, and it was pretty dark. Being the last who had entered the monastery, I had to walk first, the other monks following me. We were reciting with a loud voice a Latin psalm. We were all marching rapidly, when suddenly my feet met a large unseen object, and down I fell, rolling on the floor. My next companion did the same, and rolled over me, and so did 5 or 6 others, who in the dark had also struck their feet on that object. In a moment we were 5 or 6 holy fathers, rolling on each other on the floor, unable to raise up, splitting our sides with convulsive laughter. It turned out that Father Burnett, in one of his fits of humility, had left the table a little before the rest with the permission of the superior to lay himself flat on the floor across the door. No words can describe my shame when I saw almost every day some performance of this kind under the name of Christian humility. In vain I tried to silence the voice of my intelligence, which spoke louder day after day, that such acts of humility were a mockery. In vain I said to myself, "Chiniki, thou art not come here to philosophize, but to sanctify thyself by becoming a corpse, which has no preconceived ideas, no acquired store of knowledge, no rule of common sense to guide it. Poor, wretched, sinful Chiniki, thou art here to save thyself by admiring every iota of the holy rules of your superiors, and to obey every word of their lips." I envied the humble piety of the other good fathers, who were apparently so happy, having conquered that haughty reason which was constantly rebelling in me. Twice a week I went to my guide and confessor, Father Allard, the master of novices, with my vain efforts to subdue my rebellious reason. He always gladdened me with the promise that, sooner or later, I should have that perfect peace which is promised to the humble monk when he has attained the supreme monastic perfection of considering himself a corpse. in the hands of his superiors. My sincere and constant efforts to reconcile myself to the rules of the monastery were, however, soon to receive a new and rude check. I had read in the Book of Rules that a true monk must closely watch those who live with him and secretly report to his superior the defects and sins which he detects in them. The first time I read that strange rule, my mind was so taken up by other things that I did not pay much attention to it. But the second time I studied that clause, I said, "Is it possible that we are a band of spies?" I was not long in seeing its disastrous effects. One of the fathers for whom I had a particular affection, and who had many times proven his sincere friendship, said to me one day, "For God's sake, my dear Father Chiniki, tell me if it is you who denounce me to the superior for having said that the conduct of Father Kyrgyz towards me was uncharitable." "No, my dear friend," I answered, "I never said such a thing against you." "I am glad to know that," he rejoined, "for I was told by some of the fathers that you were the one who had reported me to the superior as guilty, though I am innocent of that offense. I could not believe it." He added with tears, "I regret having left my parish to be an oblate. That abominable law makes a real hell of this monastery, and I suppose of all the monastic orders. When you have passed more time here, you will see that law of detection puts an insurmountable wall between us all. It destroys every spring of Christian and social happiness." "I understand perfectly well what you say," I answered him. "The last time I was alone with Father Superior, he asked me why I had said that the present Pope was an old fool. He persisted in telling me that I must have said it, for," he added, "one of our most reliable fathers has assured me you said it." "Well, my dear Father Superior," I answered him, "that reliable father has told you a big lie. I never said such a thing, because I sincerely think that our present Pope is one of the wisest that ever ruled the Church." I added, "Now I understand why the conversations are colorless and without life in the hours we are allowed to talk. Nobody dares to speak his mind on any grave subject." "That is just the reason," answered my friend. "When some of the fathers, like you and me, would prefer to be hung rather than become spies, the great majority of them, particularly among the French priests recently imported from France, will not hear 10 words from your lips on any subject without finding an opportunity of reporting 8 of them as unbecoming and unchristian to the superiors." "I do not say that it is always through malice that they give such false reports. It is more through want of judgment. They are here in its true sense, and they give their false impressions to the superiors, who unfortunately encourage that system of spying as the best way of transforming every one of us into corpses. As we are never confronted with our false accusers, we can never know them, and we lose confidence in each other. Thus it is that the sweetest and holiest springs of true Christian love are forever dried up." Because of this spying system, a celebrated French writer who had been a monk himself wrote, "Monks enter a monastery without knowing each other, they live there without loving each other, and they depart from each other without any regret." Not long after my reception as a novice, the superior of the seminary of St. Sulpice and grand vicar of the diocese of Montreal, the Reverend Mr. Cuvillier, knocked at our door to rest an hour and take breakfast with us. this unfortunate priest, who was among the best orators and the best looking men Montreal had ever seen, had lived such a profligate life with his penitent nuns and ladies of Montreal that a cry of indignation from the whole people had forced Bishop Bourget to send him back to France. Our Father Superior took the opportunity of his visit to make us bless God for having gathered us behind the walls of our monastery, where the efforts of the enemy were powerless. It was not long after the public fall of the Grand Vicar of Montreal when a fine-looking widow was engaged to preside over our kitchen. She was more than 40 years old and had very good manners. Unfortunately, she had not been 4 months in the monastery when she fell in love with her father confessor, one of the most pious of the French Father Oblates. Both were found in an evil hour, forgetting one of the holy laws of God. The guilty priest was punished and the weak woman dismissed, but an unspeakable shame remained upon us all. From that day forward, the strange and beautiful illusions which had brought me to the monastery faded away. I studied the Oblates with my eyes opened, and I saw them just as they were. In the spring of 1847, having a severe illness, the doctor ordered me to go to the Hotel Dieu of Montreal near the splendid St. Mary's Church. I made there the acquaintance of a venerable old nun who was very talkative. She was one of the superiors of the house. Her family name was Urtubise. Her mind was still full of indignation at the bad conduct of two Father Oblates who, under the pretext of sickness, had lately come to her monastery to seduce the young nuns who were serving them. She told me how she had turned them out, forbidding them ever to come again, under any pretext, into the hospital. After she had given me several other spicy stories, I asked her if she had known Maria Monk when she was in their house, and what she thought of her book, Awful Disclosures. "I have known her well," she said. "She spent 6 months with us. I have read her book, which was given me that I might refute it. But after reading it, I refused to have anything to do with that deplorable exposure. There are surely some inventions and suppositions in that book, but there is a sufficient amount of truth to cause all our nunneries to be pulled down by the people, if only the half of them were known to the public." She then said to me, "For God's sake, do not reveal these things to the world till the last one of us is dead. If God spares you," she then covered her face with her hands, burst into tears, and left the room. I remained horrified. I regretted having heard her words, though I was determined to respect her request not to reveal the terrible secrets she had entrusted to me. My God knows that I never repeated a word of it till now, but I think it is my duty to reveal to my country and the whole world the truth on that grave subject, as it was given me by a most unimpeachable eyewitness. Though not quite recovered, I left the same day for Longueuil, where I entered the monastery with a heavy heart. The day before, two of the fathers had come back from a 2 or 3 month evangelical excursion among the lumbermen who were cutting wood in the forest along the Ottawa River. I was glad to hear of their arrival. I hoped that the interesting history of their evangelical excursions would cause a happy diversion from the deplorable things I had recently learned. But only one of those fathers could be seen, and his conversation was anything but interesting and pleasant. There was evidently a dark cloud around him, and the other oblate, the very day of his arrival, he had been ordered to keep to his room and make a retreat of 10 days, during which time he was forbidden to speak to anyone. I inquired from a devoted friend among the old oblates the reason of such a strange thing. Poor Father D has seduced one of his fair penitents on the way. She was a married woman, the lady of the house where our missionaries used to receive the most cordial hospitality. The husband, having discovered the infidelity of his wife, came very near killing her. He ignominiously turned out the two fathers and wrote a terrible letter to the superior. Do those deplorable acts occur often among the Father Oblates? I asked my friend. My friend raised his eyes filled with tears, and with a deep sigh he answered, Dear Father Chenecky, would to God that I could tell you that it is the first, but alas, you know by what has occurred with our female cook that it is not, and you know also the abominable life of Father Telmon with the two nuns at Ottawa. If it be so, I replied, where is the spiritual advantage of the regular clergy over the secular? The only advantage I see, answered my friend, is that the regular clergy gives himself with more impunity to every kind of debauch and licentiousness than the secular. The monks, being concealed from the eyes of the public inside the walls of their monastery, where nobody, or at least very few people, have any access, are more easily conquered by the devil and more firmly kept in his chains than the secular priests. The sharp eyes of the public and the daily contact the secular priests have with their relations and parishioners form a powerful restraint upon our depraved nature. In the monastery there is no restraint except the childish and ridiculous punishments of retreats, kissing of the floor or of the feet, prostration upon the ground, as Father Brunette did a few days after your coming among us. That great and divine law of self-respect, which God himself has implanted in the heart of every man and woman who live in a Christian society, is completely destroyed in the monastery and nunnery. The foundation of perfection in the monk and the nun is that they must consider themselves as corpses. Do you not see that this principle strikes at the root of all that God has made good, grand, and holy in man? If you study the true history, not the lying history, of monasticism, you will find the details of a corruption impossible anywhere else, not even among the lowest houses of prostitution. Read the memoirs of Scipio de Risi, one of the most pious and intelligent bishops of our church has ever had, and you will see that the monks and the nuns of Italy live the very life of the brutes in the fields. Yes, read the terrible revelations of what is going on among those unfortunate men and women whom the iron hand of monasticism keeps tied in their dark dungeons. You will hear from the very lips of the nuns that the monks are more free with them than husbands are with their legitimate wives. You will see that every one of those monastic institutions is a new Sodom. Everything is mechanical, material, false in the life of a monk and a nun. Even the best virtues are deceptions and lies. Have you not remarked how those so-called monks speak with the utmost contempt of the rest of the world? I have had opportunities to see the profound hatred which exists among all monastic orders against each other. How the Dominicans have always hated the Franciscans, and how they both hate the Jesuits, who pay them back in the same coin. What a strong and nameless hatred divides the Oblates, to whom we belong, from the Jesuits. The Jesuits never lose an opportunity of showing us their supreme contempt. You are aware that it is absolutely forbidden to an Oblate to confess to a Jesuit. It is forbidden for a Jesuit to confess to an Oblate or any other priest. I have found among the monks of Canada the very same things I have seen among those of France and Italy. With very few exceptions, they are all corpses, absolutely dead to every sentiment of true honesty and real Christianity. They are putrid carcasses which have lost the dignity of manhood. I regret that the remarkable monk whose abridged views on monasticism I have here given should have requested me never to give his name. He was eventually able to obtain an assignment to preach to the savages of the Rocky Mountains, and there, without noise, he slipped out of their hands, broke his chains to live the life of a freed man in Christ, in the holy bonds of Christian marriage with a respectable American lady. I had a year earlier been a weak and timid soldier, frightened by the ruin spread everywhere on the battlefield. I looked around to find a shelter against the impending danger and thought that the monastery of the Oblates of Mary Immaculate was one of those strong towers built by my God, where the arrows of the enemy could not reach me, and I threw myself into it. Suddenly, the high towers and walls around me fell to the ground, and turned to dust. And I heard a voice saying to me, "Soldier, come out and get in the light of the sun. Trust no more in the walls built by the hand of man. They are nothing but dust. Come and fight in the open day under the eyes of God, protected only by the gospel banner of Christ. Come out from behind those walls. They are a diabolical deception, a snare, a fraud." I listened to that voice, and on the 1st of November, 1847, I bade adieu to the inmates of the monastery of the Oblates of Mary Immaculate.